Good evening. I'm Glenn Lowry, the director of the Museum of Modern Art, and I want to welcome you to tonight's Artists Speak, Conversations on Contemporary Art. Tonight's program, Playing Games, Reinventing Traditions, was to feature Arturo Herrera and Gabriel Orozco. Unfortunately, Gabriel had to go to Mexico this morning to attend to an urgent family matter. So we have the pleasure of a conversation with Arturo. Arturo's work explores the possibilities of the game and the radical and exciting potential of play. His art challenges viewers to rethink the rules of the game and to consider how art and society might look if we imagined alternative traditions and new instructions for the future. Arturo is very much an artist of the world. He was born in Venezuela. He lives and works in Berlin, and he's almost everywhere. His work can be seen in this country, in Europe, and has taken on, I think, an extraordinary importance because of the way in which he blends traditions, he explodes, and then rethinks the way in which works of art are constructed and imagined. And so it's an extraordinary pleasure that he is with us tonight. So after Arturo makes a presentation of his work, he and I will take our seats on the stage here, and we will be joined by Luis Enrique Perez Oramas, our curator of Latin American art, a friend of Arturo's. I know you're all anxious to hear Arturo speak. For more information about his biography, you can find it in the brochures that were handed out as you came in. So please welcome me. Welcome Arturo with me.
Good evening, and thanks for coming to lecture. I'm really sorry Gabriel is not here to be part of this conversation. I was looking forward to hearing him and meeting him in person, but apparently his family had a problem. So anyway, so you have to deal only with me tonight. So I thought that I will begin with showing some early pieces around 1998, some early collages, and then go on from there. There will be a variety of media, so just kind of these are just around maybe six or five collages from 1998 and around 9 by 12 inches, and uses inexpensive papers and, you know, found paper. And so most of the collages have very very little manipulation. I try not to change so much, just as little as I could do to make the intervention. So here there's only two shapes or two fragments of paper on top of the cartoon. Here has just cuts on the sheets and then glued together. Usually I tend to work in series, so they can go from 25 to 50 and or even longer, larger series. Again, this is a found piece of paper illustration, and then there's a painted form in the front. This is a very small collage. Also, I think it's 1996, 1997, and the brown marks and the black marks were done. They were found in the, I guess they were drawn by a child, and I just found it like that. So, from here, I'm just going to move to a series of a little bit much more complicated collages that were done. Also, in series of 65 collages called Keep in Touch. And I hire an illustrator. These are from 2005. And the backgrounds are taken from animated films and with the characters deleted. And so these are original paintings made out of wash. And the backgrounds were repeated five times. And there are 13 motifs, so there's 65 of them. So again, the intervention is only one piece of paper. on top of the painting that's behind it. So just a ink drawing on top of this snow landscape. So there's 5 sets of this series, Keep in Touch. Here there is an example of 2 pieces of paper on top of the painting. So a watercolor, which is a Y form, and then a finger painting of acrylic. Another example of 2 pieces of paper. This background is from a Disney film. I don't know if you could recognize it, but with the characters deleted. And sometimes the backgrounds have changed a little bit, but you have to see the whole series to find out the difference between them, or among them. Here's Mylar with acrylic and pencil on top of this. This is a background from the Three Little Pigs. That's one of the houses of the pigs. Can you tell where this is from?
Pinocchio.
This is when they put smoke to get out of the whale. So again, this is a finger painting directly on the painting. This is how they looked. They has been shown like that twice, once in New York and once in a museum in Galicia. Now they're separated, and hopefully they will be shown together again, but it was a really nice opportunity to see them like this, so you can actually move back and forth and try to connect different backgrounds and the different interventions on each of the backgrounds, and this kind of relation to kind of the moving image because there were backgrounds from film. This is the latest series of collages that was shown here in New York last year. These are 98 inches by 48 inches. They were shown here in New York on frame, so people could see how they were made. It's a combination of mixed media. This, for example, has photocopies, the black shapes, which are taken from photocopies of my own collages and photographs, and then there is painting the orange part, and then the yellow and the magenta is a cutout, and the whole series of these collages is there's 75 of them, and it's called the Boy and Dwarf series. It uses a boy that and a dwarf that I found in a coloring book, and I tried to obliterate the image as far as I could go, so they're almost purely abstract. But if you start looking, if you see them all together, you probably start finding out elements of the shoes and the hats and elements that identify the dwarf and the boy. As you can see, they're hard to read, but they're there. This is, for example, this is a frontal view of a dwarf. I don't know if you can see. Here are some shoes. And here's some grass. And here's the eyes. And here's a big hat. Can you see that? No. Okay. Well, it's a frontal dwarf with a big mustache. And it's looking at us. It is a crouching figure, and his hands are in the back. And I hired the same illustrator who did the backgrounds for Keep in Touch, and I just sent the frontal views, and I told him, can you just do the back views, whatever you want. So he sent the back view of the boy and the back view of the dwarf, and then the cutouts were made for the series. Oh, here, okay. Here are the eyes. Here's the mustache. Here's the hat. With a big, and here are the arms, and here are the shoes, and the grass. Here's a back of a dwarf with a hat, looking, and here are the clenched fists, and here are the shoes again. But I wanted to kind of these figures, which I found in a Caracas bookstore. This is kind of a generic coloring book. These are not Disney figures, but I was attracted to this crouching dwarf, which was kind of scary, and the boy playing the accordion. So I just said, how far can I take them to obliterate them from the collage? But you know, these are, you can see them here, that are just, they're totally flat, but they're cutouts on top of the paintings on the collages. So it's a complete kind of a extravagant way of taking these collages as far as it could go. Here's another dwarf. Here's a boy with the accordion. Here's the big eyes and the big head. And here's the accordion, here's the finger playing, and here the... Again, it's not important to know that, but the series is called Boy and Dwarf, and so the more you see them in groups, you start identifying different parts, just like in the Keep in Touch series. Here's a frontal boy also. They're identified as BF2 or BF or DF, or for, you know, dwarf front or dwarf back or boy front. Here's the back of a dwarf. Oh, look, here we go. So this is the latest series of collages. The year before I did these, this is an installation in Torino, where the photos from 2005, and this also these collages from 2005. The paper is just cut directly and then glued to the wall. Here's some examples of, again, the forms are derived from drawings, ink drawings or pencil drawings. These are not found in drawing shapes. They're just from my drawings, sketches. And here we go to sculpture. Couple of samples. This is a very tiny, tiny piece from 1998. It was cut with laser and then spray with car paint. It's very thin. MDF pieces, you know, MDF like felt is actually it's a very inexpensive material, and it cuts very easily and it's easily painted, so it's ideal. It's like the paper from the coloring books is just available. It's inexpensive, and you could just cut it in any form. It's ideal for me, this material. Here's another MDF piece installation in Galicia in the Museum of Centro Gallego. And this is also MDF with, you know, four or five colors. This is a very small piece, also painted and then sprayed. All the sculptures are flat, so they just... they're like collage to the architecture. Here's a... in Berlin, I'm now starting making steel pieces. I don't know why, but it's just... I find attractive this material now. So this is the first piece I did, and I'm making two more on different scales. This was derived from a drawing, from a coloring book, and then twisted a little bit, but it's almost directly quotation from that character. Here's a large, this is I think 70 by 45 inches. It's two pieces of MDF with a wall painting behind it. The green piece is wall, it's painted directly on the wall, and then the piece is collage on top of that piece. So from here we go to felt pieces, and these are from late 90s to 2001-2002. So again, felt cuts easily, just like MDF, and these are all cut by hand with X-Acto blade. And again, they feel like specifically kind of collage to the architecture or to the wall. They're not framed. Felt is pure pigment, so it cuts easily, and you can order in every different color. In Germany right now, it's a great opportunity because they have the best felt makers there. So you can order all kinds of felt in different colors and different thicknesses. So I'm having a show in June, and it will be all felt pieces, but not with holes in it, just uncut. These are all the shapes for the felts are taken from drawings, from ink drawings, from the studio. Here we have the photographs that were shown before from the installation in Torino. And this is one piece, it's 80 photographs, and these were taken, I had the camera in the studio, I just photographed whatever was around the studio with a micro lens, and so basically I fragmented even more whatever was around, laying around pieces of paper, tiny fragments. The studio is full of paper, so I realized that this could be a possibility of fragmenting even more whatever that was around in the studio. So then the rolls of film were put into water, and whatever happened with the roll by chance then was printed. So here are some examples of these photos. These were printed in Ilford paper, which is they don't make it anymore, and by a printer in Berlin. And these are all 9 by 12 inches, approximately. The shapes around that line drawing is from a drawing of mine, but everything else came from the film. I never knew what I was going to get actually from the water seeping into the roll of film, so it was a great project to see probably every week something different. And now we're going to go into the wall paintings. Here's an installation of the collages Keep in Touch, and then the wall painting Tell from the on the left. The thing on the top, I don't know if you've been there before, but this is the Alvaro Siza building in Galicia. It's very difficult to work there in that space just because this is the lighting system that he devised for the building. It's basically an inverted table, and the light kind of flows from the top into the walls. But the walls are very, very heavy to work with, so they produce a shadow in the middle of the room. So difficult to work with, but we manage. This is the first room of the exhibition in Galicia. Here's when you enter the exhibition. This is a piece from 1995. Here is a piece commissioned by the Stuttgart Museum, and this is the first version of the pieces upstairs, Atomic Abstraction. This is the first, the first version. Then the version that's here is a double version, which was flipped and inverted. So and this show was Michel Maggiore's also. Here's in Worcester. I kind of made a comment on the Roman mosaics and the elements of how I got inside this interior space. So it kind of quotes the building very abstractly. Here's the hammer in LA. These are taken from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. When I do commissions, architectural commissions, or I tend to go to the space and think carefully about you know, how people use the space, how they walk up and down, how you enter, how you exit. So this was a very site-specific project. So this is a commission that took 4 years in the making due to the red tape, but anyway, it's finally done. And this is in Chicago. He kind of uses all imagery, but that's when we started the project, and now I don't do this anymore, but this is what the commission and now is finally made. And so this is Department of Homeland Security. So so nobody has access to see this painting, except for the people that go there to get permits or citizenship or green cards. So it's very hard to get in that building. Here's, I'll show you in a way, you know, this was a very difficult wall painting to realize because of the, again, because it's the Alvaro Siza building. And it has this very, you will see, this is just, I want to walk you through the how you, this is the first gallery, two cutouts on the left and right, I think from 2002, 2001. This is the second gallery with, again, the drawing on the right is the painting here, the wall painting at MoMA right now. And this is a quadruple version of that on the right. Here we have photos and some other cutouts. And here you can see how the ceiling drops, like, I don't know, 5 meters. And there's a bridge that goes to the to a door, to a window. So here's a wall painting, kind of in reference to Santiago, in reference to the building. So this is taken from one of the collages for Keep in Touch. So there's different views. The wall is 11 meters high. It's a huge, huge wall. And this was made by, not by a regular sign painter, but by a movie poster painter, one of those dying breed of painters that it's hard to find now. And we found one in Madrid, and he came and painted this in like a week. Here's another view. Here's ICI Philadelphia, a private home commission. Here's a Berlin project, 2005. I did 3 wall paintings in 2005, and I'll show you. I tried different materials. For this case, I hired Swiss painters who work for Bridget Riley, and they're very exact and very expensive. And but they did a perfect job with this wall piece. This is a very difficult thing to do. It was extremely time-consuming, and the images are not on top of the lines. They're actually exactly at the level with the lines. It was very hard to do. This is the gallery of the DEADE in Berlin, of the academic program, the exchange program. So I had 3 wall paintings happening at the same time. So I'll show you. This is this was not in Berlin. This was in Basel. This is, I never tried this material before, but the Swiss painters, their father used to make gold leaf, so I thought, why don't we make a gold leaf painting? And so this is my first try on gold leaf wall painting. Here's another of the 2005 Berlin projects. This is a drawing done with a cartoon process where the paper is perforated, and then with a powder color. We use, I think, black and red for this. And then we just pounce direct. I mean, we just hit the cartoon directly to transfer the drawing, and that was the piece. So here is how it looked. It's 3 castles connected with lines and the clouds, and the line on the bottom is all the residue of the powder, of the pigment. And again, this is a very specific space in Berlin. And I wanted not to bring color to it. I just wanted to kind of recall the bricks and keep it as quiet as possible. And here's the last of that 2005 wall paintings. This is called firewall is painted directly on the wall and it's still there. So if you go to Berlin, you can see it. And it's aging very nicely because the repairs are coming through the wall. And I wanted to have a very light touch of black. So the holes from the repairs are coming through very nicely. So so that's the last piece. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Arturo. I have to declare this so that we have some truth in advertising here. There is a Venezuelan axis that is being established along this side of the discussion, but I'm here to balance that out to make sure that we have a fully international position. Arturo, do you want to start with talking about why collage? What is it about collage that attracts you so much?
Well, to be honest, I think collage started just because when I was living in New York, I was in a very poor situation, and collage allowed me to get as much access to paper. So Goodwill and odd job stores were available to be able to get these materials, and then from then on, I started working in a small table that allowed me to start actually thinking how these recognizable images, this already this language that was there, could be transformed by just doing two or three cuts. And by just using gluing and X-Acto Blade, you can actually jump from another level. So I said, let's try it and see how that goes. And then that jumped into other things. So, and then that's how it happened.
Do you create rules for yourself when you're working? Do you sort of invent a system and then play with it? Or do you just sort of let it happen organically?
Well, I think with the relation with play that I have with the work is that, you know, collage, I think you, when you start a new series, you think it's always going to be very easy and you will get it done in very, you know, in no time. But what happens is collage, for each of the series, it tends to be like a struggle to be able to achieve what you want to achieve. So basically, I have to put everything out, all the boxes with all the fragments have to be out, and then it becomes kind of a physical kind of game to kind of walking around the studio, you know, walking and being standing on your feet for hours, and then an intellectual kind of play to be able to select the fragments, and then you have to kind of, hopefully they work. So I don't set rules for myself in the sense of they have to be this way, but it tends to be, each series of collages tend to be very specific for the time, and I can't foresee what's going to happen, but I have to have everything out and then start rehearsing. And the more that I stay with this group of fragments and the collages that I'm making, it's like I'm playing, I get better at the play, basically.
It sounds like what you do is you start with chopping things up.
Yes.
So you have boxes in your studio.
Boxes of thousands of fragments.
And are they organized in any kind of way? Circles, squares, lines?
No, they're just small, random, medium, large.
So here we are in your studio. We've got small, medium, large, and you start just pulling things out of the box once you've finished cutting things up, and throwing them on the table and seeing how they line up with each other.
Right. It's about a kind of a strange situation. You don't know where you're going to go. And for example, I just finished for London five collages or six collages, and I thought, oh, you know, this will be so easy. I will just make it in 1 week. It will be no time. And it's actually taking 2 months to be able to realize that what I wanted to do is not so available. Even with all the fragments out, for some specific reason, they don't want to be joined with this piece of paper. So the relationship between what's going to happen, I can't foresee that. So these collages feel very different from the ones you saw now. So I wonder why is that every time I take the fragments are in boxes. I don't see them very often. Only when I'm going to jump in this thing, and that is really when the play begins, because I don't know where I'm going to go.
Well, then I have a question about composition, Arturo. Because it seems that your work is strongly grounded on a tradition, on a modern tradition of found images. In a way, and Gabriel Orozco also, not exclusively, but found objects. let's say, a tradition that goes back to ready-made or assisted ready-made. And on one hand, your work seems to be strongly grounded on those found images, on those boxes of fragments. But you are reintroducing a strong compositional component. Your works are beautifully labored, composed. And in a way, that tradition of found images and found objects struck against the conventional idea of composition. So I see a very beautiful example, in both cases, Gabriel and Arturo, of something in contemporary art going forward, grounded on a modern tradition, and backward, reintroducing this idea of composition and these strong compositional tasks. And personally, I think this backward is very positive. It's very interesting. And I wanted to get, if you have something to say about that, this, how do you manage these two things? I mean, the repertoire of found images, and then, which is obvious, the strong task of composition you implement on your works.
Well, what I found is that, you know, when I started working with the coloring book, which was the first time that I started working with collages, I'm not so much doing that right now, but it was like more, you know, it was like a biomorphic abstraction, mm-hmm. ready-made. Especially the Disney illustrators, the way they did everything, it was like having art, you know, ready to be cut. And so it was a dialogue, it was already a connection with that, and basically I just have to cut it into, it was just readily available for me to use it. And then I just have to reconstruct it to make a composition. I think I'm interested in the solidity of this thing, of this composition. It might sound conservative or it might sound old-fashioned, but there's a certain kind of way to these ways that you kind of arrange the fragments to create another image that is as solid as the ones where they came from. Now, living in Germany, you see a lot of that is anti-form or anti-composition. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see that sometimes that works too.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, but I think I'm more inclined to be on this side.
Is the choice of your source subject matter random? In other words, when you turn to comic books, especially to Disney characters, is that simply a function of availability, or is it a function of a kind of interest in the nature of popular culture and the way in which that culture can be taken apart and put back together?
Well, I think it's both. I think it's availability and also the ideas of references that we all have to, like Pinocchio.
I was very impressed, by the way, whoever got Pinocchio.
And everybody had references to some of the images they saw. So that, it kind of taps this universal language. So it's very important to kind of just create something else with these images that are readily available. But it also, it goes beyond this, you know, it's popular culture that now actually touches all of us. And in which ways can we, you know, direct or that dialogue? I mean, that's what I'm interested in. So.
At some point, Arturo say that when he was projecting the images of his sculptures, all the sculptures are flat,
yeah.
Which I found a very, very interesting way to describe. All the sculptures are flat.
They're
and then
flat.
If we see the drawings, all the drawings are dense and layered. In a way, there is kind of an inversion. All the sculptures are flat. And then within the flatness of drawings, you are working on this idea of density and layers and the malleability of surfaces. And I see like a beautiful inversion of a conventional idea of, I mean, sculpture and drawing. It's drawing something flat and sculpture something that is not flat.
Right, so this, yeah, the collages tend to be allowed for you to go inside. Yeah,
exactly.
And but also, since it's paper, you know, there's just like a wall, and it's like a forest. But the sculptures are just as flat as possible. I don't know. I mean, I tend to go between, you know, total monochromatic, pure abstraction, and then this other kind of referential to pop culture. But it's all mixed together. I don't know. Maybe I think it happens to some artists. Maybe that after
the collages of the boys and dwarf, I couldn't continue that kind of excess. So I had to go a complete minimal. That's the show in London, which will happen in June. So it's as minimal as it could be. It needs breaks, basically. I need breaks in between the practices. I can't go on with that kind of tone or intensity.
I just want to pick up on this issue of composition a little bit, because one of the most striking aspects of your work, when you look at it, you know, writ large, as you showed it to us, is what at least on the surface appears to be really subtle but very effective referencing, for instance, of abstract expressionism and the kind of drip-like qualities of Pollock, and yet it's the result of presumably very exacting labor on your part. Or in the Boy and Dwarf series, I couldn't help thinking of a certain kind of cubism that fractures the image and puts it back together in a different way. And I wonder to what degree you are engaging with earlier traditions, consciously or not.
Well, I think with the Boy and Dwarf series, I wanted to take all those things and put it in the blender, basically. You know, there's Rauschenberg, there's Pollock, there's de Kooning, there's, you know, Berlin newspapers, there is printed matter, there's geometric patterns, there is pop art, there is op art. And how much can we blend it in and then just spit it out? Using these basic figures of a boy and a dwarf that we all have somewhat reference to, but then I'll try to obliterate it. So it's like I was going with this series and as far as I could go with this idea of culture, the idea of entering the collage, because it's so complicated, there's so many layers, and then actually the collages are as flat as possible too, just, you know, so there's this kind of giant wall that you can enter, but it invites you to wander in. So in seeing the way that they were shown here and the way they were shown in Berlin, it was meant to kind of just to pick up fragments from the elements of the cutouts to be able to make sense of this kind of forest, because they were hung very close together. That was the idea for that. But yeah, I agree. The Boys and Dwarves uses all these references, you know, pop, art history, social, into blending them and juxtaposing them as flat as possible to create some kind of dialogue.
I take the opportunity of that question and that answer to ask a Venezuelan question.
I knew there was going to be a Venezuelan moment here.
No, you are from Venezuela. I know that. But you became an artist in the U.S.
Yes.
And my impression is that your work has more to do with an American repertoire than with the Latin American context. I see something that goes, as you just mentioned, from pop and found images and American pop and to, on the other hand, abstract expressionism, late de Kooning, to Shu Williams, through Bryce Martin, and then you blend it in a way you just explained. However, there is something in your work that I relate to a critical moment in Venezuelan art, when the tradition of hard-edged structures, syneticism, concretism, concrete art, was questioned by artists such as Gego. Now there is an exhibition of Gego in New York at the Drawing Center, or Roberto Obregón, a known artist here, or Eugenio Espinosa, all of them artists who stress the malleability of structures, this idea that structures are this have this capacity to fold and unfold ceaselessly, and also this idea that there is an ambiguity between void and fullness. And I see that in your work. And I would like to ask you about if ever you think of those as reference for you, or if you, how do you see your relationship to Venezuelan art, if there is one?
Well, it's clear there is there. As you can see in the Berlin Gallery project, that is clearly a reference to kinetic art. And I mean, I grew up with these artists. I know the collections in the museums. My father and mother took me to these museums. I grew up with this book, so they're part of my DNA, basically. Mm. So so they're all there. I mean, by using this kind of geometric, or by using this exterior interior, it's all part of there. I mean, I don't use specifically works of art to be able to criticize or to take or to quote, but it's all part of the dialogue. But,
for example, Obregón is someone you think of, or Roberto?
Well, I have an affinity with him, but I don't think about him in the sense of, like, I need to... Yeah. So.
I'm sorry for mentioning the name.
No, you're allowed to do that. Let's flip the question around a little bit, which is that one of the things that, I think so many of us are impressed by your work is its transnationalism, its ability actually to very effectively slip across borders. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about what it's like to be a Latin American artist working in the heart of Europe, in Berlin, and the degree to which your position there affects your work, informs your work, and the relationships you have with a really interesting community of artists that has now coalesced in Berlin: Janet Cardiff, Mona Hatoum, Olafur Eliasson, Thomas Demond, etc.
Well, I think what the moves the I was living in New York, and then I received the call that I was going to Berlin, and I welcomed the change. And the longer I'm there, I realize that it's actually very good for the practice, because it allows a certain dialogue in the city with all these artists and with so many galleries, and many things are happening there, and you see the worst shows and the best shows, but you're not really sure if these are the best things you're seeing or the worst things. So there is that kind of experimentation. So and that's allowed there. I think in New York it's maybe not so much allowed. And you could fail beautifully in Berlin, and that's okay. But here's a little bit much more careful that that cannot happen. So it allows for a certain freedom, and many artists that live there, they're much more relaxed. So it informs the practice also, and being in close practice with German artists and the way they think, on the way they behave about art regarding materials, composition, and their history. So it has been a really challenging for me, but very generous to be there. I mean, and being Latin America, it actually doesn't inform the work, or it doesn't inform me. You know, it doesn't, you know, label me as, I'm just part of the community of the international artists living there, like Damian Ortega, and like, you know, Mona Hatoum, and so we're all there, and so we all connect, we all talk, and it's just, it's part of this experiment that's happening in Berlin right now.
Let's keep on the subject for a moment of experimentation, because I think one of the things that's really striking about your work is that it may involve collaging, but what really comes through is a kind of restlessness, a constant effort to find new ways of making art, whether it's in felt or in your steel sculptures or wall drawings or the cutouts or not just manipulating photography but destroying photography. And I just wonder how that sense of experimentation runs through your work and what it is you're looking to do.
Well, I think it comes from collage, this idea of tactility. So the felts, the scale of the felts, and the way they're placed on the wall. I mean, the photography also, you know, the paper that I use for this Ilford paper is a very specific paper that is discontinued now. The steel which I started in Berlin, it's a complete different way that people have a different reference to that. So I think that, I mean, I don't work with all materials. I mean, I don't work with rubber, I don't work with glass, I don't work... But I mean, the materials that I use tend to have a certain kind of memory with people, a certain connection, just like the fragments they see juxtaposed in different ways. So they use the materials, hopefully have this idea of tactility in which ways viewers tend to connect with that or to reference that. So, I mean, a piece of felt on a wall with holes in it or without holes in it, people are going to have a certain kind of private reading. So I think it's kind of an intimate reading to see these materials with some kind of image that they tend to know where they're coming from, but they can't actually pinpoint what it is. So that places them in a very private kind of conversation. The titles are very obscure. They're untitled most of the time or very open. So this kind of ambiguity, the subjectivity with the material and with the image, hopefully will allow to have a private kind of a connection with the viewer.
That sense of privacy and the ability to reference, even in an abstracted form, popular culture. Are your works narrative? Do they have a structure to them? Do they have an internal story that's being told, or are they really to be read as a formal response?
Well, I think the works, they offer a narrative, but it's not non-linear. You know, they have this, you recognize aspects of landscape or body parts or architecture, and they kind of make a sense of a certain story, but it's not really given to you either by the title or by the fragments that are represented. So you're in a place of total connection with the thing in a very private way. So
like visual known places.
Right. You can a little bit level, a good level of ignorance, which is I'm interested in. Not, I don't want it by the title saying, you know, identifying or clarifying everything. I think I'm more towards subjectivity, mm-hmm. which kind of doesn't reassure the viewer, but I'm interested in that. So.
What about music? I know that you are passionate of music, and maybe something is in the works.
Well, actually, yeah, the piece is finished. I will rework it in a different. It's based on a Stravinsky ballet from 1923, and it uses the photographs and other drawings, and always a syncopated kind of a slideshow with digital projection. It's being shown right now in Icon Gallery in Birmingham, but after seeing it there, I think I need to do another version of it. Mm. This was open into it was shown in a wide space with two doors, and it worked very well there. But I think I need to do another version. So I will do like this opera composers that will have a Paris version, mm-hmm. and New York version. So there will be a new version of this called Lenos, the Wedding by Stravinsky.
And then the unfinished version.
And then the unfinished version, exactly. So, but that's exciting. I've never done this before. I never worked with digital projection. So it's interesting for me to be able to have some kind of music, which is, you know, part of the canon of modernism with Diaghilev, Nijinsky, Goncharova, and Nijinska. And then I'm trying to collage basically images into this film.
You know, there's an interesting, dialogue, if that's the right word, between the kind of tiling that you create, this layering of images, and then their abstraction and their recombination that allows for these multiplicity of readings that exists in your work, and you know the recent paintings of artists like Jeff Koons, which have really tried to do a similar kind of collaging, tiling, and layering, but his work derives entirely from his ability to manipulate images in a digital format on a computer screen, then have them painted. Your work, which looks like it must be the result of manipulations in the digital world, is in fact all handcrafted.
Right.
Are you drawn to working digitally? Is it?
No, I don't. I have a computer in the studio, but I don't use it very often, and everything is cut by hand. And what I buy in New York every time I come is tons and tons of blades.
It must make it very easy for you to move through airports.
But the good blades, there's Japanese blades here and there's American blades, so I just get different kinds, and everything is done with scissors and blades. And the digital aspect, I feel like I'm losing this tactility about the material. So the felt is cut by hand, the collages are all glued and cut by hand, so I mean, the steel, I can't do that by hand, but I don't want to lose that. In the digital, I'm not so comfortable with it. So.
I think in one of your series, at least, you actually took comics, photographed them, and then cut up the photographs themselves, did you not? Or am I imagining that?
I mean, I could have done that as a part of a project, but it's not a complete series, probably. So, but yeah, everything is allowed in the studio, but I don't tend to use so much digital or computer work to create the pieces. So,
let's turn these questions over to all of you and give you a chance to ask what you might want. And don't be shy. If there are any questions. Yes, please.
Hi.
Speak loudly.
Hi, well, first of all, thank you for this talk. I was very much expecting it for a long time. Arturo, you were talking about the ambiguity of your work, and I was wondering how can you talk about that regarding the feelings that you try to transmit through your pieces, or that or they just transmit by themselves, in terms of the this feeling of they are playful, but at the same time, they are kind of mysterious, even in a, not in a bad way, but very not perverse. I don't know what's the word. I will prefer that you say the word.
Well, I mean, they're all that what you said. You know, they're violent, they're perverse, they're decadent, they're playful, they're so. I think the ambiguity or the openness of the work allows for each of us to bring our baggage into them. And that could be a very good baggage or a very playful baggage or a very complicated, complex ideas of how to read the pieces. I have been surprised by how people react to some of the works. And that's all allowed. So because I'm not dictating the readings through titles or materials that are very charged. So yeah, it's specifically to each person the way they read them.
This is something that you plan carefully in advance, or is something that it comes out and it you notice it after you finish your work?
No, I try to not to inform the work so much by, you know, by allowing the shape to be this way, or by, you know, having a picture of somebody recognizable in the collage and trying to get away from that. So it will be so easy to put Paris Hilton or a political figure in a collage, but I try not to do that. So to make the work a little bit much more directed towards you in a different way. So, using popular culture, which we all have connection with.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Firstly, I found your talk absolutely fascinating. And then I have a few questions. A factual question, since I'm going to Berlin shortly, I'd like to know where that building is, the one that was on your last slide on the outside wall. Where, was it commissioned or whatever? How did it happen to be on a wall which seems to be in an area which is either in transition or being rebuilt or whatever? Then a question in regard to the way you work. Is everything or most everything or some of it created by yourself, meaning using your own actual work workmanship? Or is a lot of it with the help of artisans, craftsmen, and so on? How much of the completed work, say, wall paintings, is your own hand in it?
Right. Well, the wall in Berlin, it's in a very... Berlin is still in fluxes, so it's changing all the time. So that wall might be covered up next year because it's very expensive real estate. There are 6 galleries in that building, but that building has a very strange history. I won't go into it, but it has... When it goes back to the Nazi Party, it goes back even. It used to be a dance hall, and used to be the center for the newspapers there. So the building is very charged for a reason. But there are 6 galleries in that building. So it's a very central part of Mitte in Berlin. So you can see it, and you will find it. There's a giant balloon that people could go up in the air, up and down. If you see the balloon, that's where it is. So
that's, you can't miss it, honestly.
You can't miss it.
You can't miss it.
So it's in the Mitte.
It's in Mitte, exactly. And regarding the materials, the collages, of course, are done by me. The large series of Boys and Dwarfs, I have to have assistance they were very large to manipulate in the studio, and there were countless paintings and cutouts and gluing that takes just hours to do. It's impossible to do it by myself. The smaller collages I do, but the series Keep in Touch, I commissioned the backgrounds from this illustrator. He delivered the backgrounds, and then I did the interventions. The metal pieces were done by fabricators, you know, the sculptures, the flat sculptures. And the wall paintings, the last one I did was the hammer piece with the staircase. And actually, I got really sick, my arm, because I was there for, I think, 2 weeks doing that wall painting. And after that, I said, I don't do this anymore. And because physically it was very, very exhausting. And I said, there's other people that could do it better than me. But it's good that I did many before, so I know I could tell the sign painters, be careful with this, don't do this, use this painter. So I had hands-on experience, but that was the last one I did, and the hammer, in 2001.
Do you have a cartoon to show them?
Yeah, I make the drawing to scale. I go to the building, I measure this, they send me the architectural drawings, and that is sent to the sign painter, either in Brussels or in Germany or in Los Angeles, which is the American sign painter I use.
For those of you who have not seen Arturo's wall drawings and wall paintings, as he mentioned in his talk, there's a very beautiful one in Comic Abstraction, which is the exhibition curated by Roxana Markoch on the third floor of the museum. And I urge you to take a look the next time you have a moment, because they are not only visually compelling, but they are scaled in such a way that they really become panoramic. Yes, in the middle.
Hi, first of all, thank you. I was interested in a point, not a point, but a word that you used a few times in your lecture. You used the word intervention, as you know, very specifically in terms of artistic decision making. And I guess I was just interested in that as a verb, intervene, to, you know, to take something and to, you know, cut it off or to stop it or to remake. And I guess, so I guess I'm asking, like, is that specific to your process, or do you view that as like more of a critical criteria for contemporary artists? And, you know, given the state of contemporary art, like, do we intervene into something that already exists, or do we, you know, make decisions? Do we have intentions? So, kind of an abstract question. But
I wouldn't make it so complicated as I'm intervening with this fragment of Pinocchio and I'm going to creep. No, I will say it's just maybe just how can only one action, one intervention, could create a different image that I've never seen before. So the intervention is just, I think, a call for action, or, you know, a call for the process of reuniting or juxtaposing. Or so, yeah, it's just I don't have a critical attachment to intervention.
But it does, to play off of that a little bit, there is a kind of tension between certain works that you've done that are about a minimalist gesture. What's the simplest thing I can do to alter an image? Drop the film in water and see what chance will do. To, let's take the Boy and Dwarf series or some of the very elaborate cutouts that are as complicated as can be. They're the opposite of a simple gesture. They're about multiple interventions. And I'm interested in, you know, whether you see a kind of game between simplicity and complexity.
Well, I think for me it's a necessity to be able to go back and forth between the two. One fits the other. So it's like part of a thing, a breathing connection. Maybe it had to do maybe with music, this kind of... So to be able to do the Boys and Dwarves, I have to have like this kind of monumental energy to get this thing out. And then after that, I was totally deleted. I couldn't go on with this, and then it goes into this very minimal aspect. But again, it's the same decision-making in both of the processes.
Do you listen to music when you're making these pieces?
Yeah, always.
What do you listen to?
It's mostly classical music, so opera or, you know, classical. So my assistant here in New York always uses NPR, but I can't listen to NPR because I have to stop whatever I'm doing to listen to what they're saying. But he works also with, you know, with the NPR going, so I can. I could work with music, But some people can't work with music because they feel like they have to stop to what the musicians are doing. So I'm the opposite. I could let the music go in the background. So, but yeah, classical music will be always in the background.
There's some questions in the back. Yes, sir.
Arturo, I just had a couple of questions. One was if you could describe how the role of chance operations occurs in your work, at what point in the composition of images, and how that functions in various projects. And then the other question I had was, do you think it would be reasonable to compare some of the procedural systems that you work with in your own work in terms of processing images to some of the modernist music systems, like 12-tone systems, for instance?
Is that Josiah McElhaney? Am I?
Yes.
I think we should just acknowledge the presence of one of this country's great artists, Josiah McElhaney, who had a project here. And thank you for being with us, Josiah.
A
complicated question.
The second part of the question was challenging.
A structural system for music. I can't read music, and I don't have enough music information to be able to understand the breakup that happened after Wagner and then that Schoenberg took after that. So I don't have enough information to be able to relate this, connection between my work and those European breakups of music structures. And the first question was?
I'm just talking about the role of chance operations, when it occurs in the process.
Well, I think chance always operates in the studio for me. So sometimes it's intentional. Or sometimes it's just deliberate how, like, for example, the Rosso films where, dripped in water, hot water, cold water, so they were written down, but you never know what you were good. So that was a chance operation that was somewhat systematic, but the chance operation in the work is always there, but I cannot label it, or I cannot say in this year I used this system of chance, but it's part of my practice, so I just let it. I welcome it, whatever, when they come. So.
Yes, please.
I have a question about games.
Well, we'll get you a microphone so everyone can hear you.
I have a question about games, because I think also it's a double question, because I'm kind of curious, what kind of game are you playing with your viewer? And also, do you play games? What are your favorite games? What do you play in your life?
I think the game with the viewer is... I'm not trying to put the viewer in some kind of rules and games and entrances and exits. The images are made, especially, in a very kind of open way to be able for you to appropriate them in a very personal way. No. You could reference the work in many different kinds of games because they allow that kind of entrance and exits, in losing and winning, or in trying this and this in couples, and I mean, it's or pairs or odds, and so the work has that possibility. And what games I play? I don't. So there's enough games in the studio, so that's enough.
In back, is that Josh?
Arturo, this perhaps is an observation more than a question, and maybe you'll respond to it or maybe not, but one of the things that I love about your work is the way that you play with gravity and weightlessness. And when we think of collage, we think of ideas of flat spaces. When we talk about, and I don't want to oversimplify things, but when we talk about op art or pop art, we're talking about movements that recede or come outwards. But the movements that I'm also interested in your work are the up and down movements. And when you look at the felt pieces, for example, you certainly have that sense of weightiness and lightness. And I think of course, maybe because of the material you're using, of Robert Morris. So the wonderful thing about your work, of course, is that we've brought so many associations, so many periods of 20th century in art in making references. But for me, one of the interesting ones is that idea of gravity that I associate with Morris and artists with that period.
Well, I mean, the Morris pieces to me are very important. I saw them since the early times when I was younger, and I would like to use the felt in a different way than I've used it. Like the new pieces is kind of a first step into that, even though they're flat and even though they're on the wall. But there has been games in the studio where I've broken it up out of the, you know, just like Louis did. And the gravity of the felt actually is an important part, but I need to experiment more than that with this. I don't want to cut the felts in this time anymore. So how can I achieve this kind of gravity with solid pieces of felt? So that will be the next challenge, so to try.
The felt pieces also seem all about scale. They're the magnitude of them creates a very different kind of relationship with the viewer than almost any of your other work except the wall drawings.
Well, I think with the wall drawings, I think I did wall drawings first, and that was a perfect opportunity to exchange the scale from a collage that's 9x12 into a wall paint that was designed specifically for a space that people tend to use. So how can an image that is ambiguous, subjective, go on a wall that was not intended by the architect to be painted, but temporarily will be painted for 3 months? And what will be the reaction of the people or the audience? So that's what I was interested in, not dictating the way how this painting will, you know, inform the space, but how the viewer will actually get some kind of nourishment or some kind of experience, basically. So the collage, I think the wall paintings and the felts have this way of scale to be able to embrace you momentarily for a time.
Yes?
Hi. I had a question that sort of ties into the idea of scale and gesture. And depending on which, let's say, abstract expressionism, like Pollock, for example, or de Kooning, or Guston, for that matter, there's always a sense of the scale of the body in relationship to a sort of gesture or scale. And something that I noticed throughout your work that was really interesting and ambiguous was how all of the imagery is all handmade. Even the backdrops that are from pop or popular culture for the sets normally are rather small, and they get enlarged quite large, you know, in a movie, for example. And so I was just wondering how you decide or what causes you to sort of go between the sources of something that's obviously been handmade and drawn, and then enlarging that to become physical again, or theatrical for that matter.
Well, you know, it's very, for me, it's, I tend to labor a lot in the studio to find out which images might work in this scale or might not work in this scale. To me, it's a very time-consuming process, and some images will just not work in this scale. And so it's just a matter of, like, setting up some kind of, not rules, but I think understanding where the image will be is important, and in which ways, if this is a series, in which ways it will be read. And, for example, the Galicia wall painting, that was a very... You could have done anything in that wall painting, but due to that bridge, the Alvaro Siza there, would not function. It had to be a specific image that will kind of relate to the city of, because through that wall, through the window, you could see the bricks that were represented in the painting. So it takes me a long, long time to find out what will be the right image for the right space and what will be the scale. Some scales don't work, actually. And the show that's happening now in June, I'm dealing with scale of felts. What is the right scale for these images? And it has been a very time consuming. So it doesn't come so easy. I think the scale decisions for me.
I should also say we welcome Ernesto Caivano, an artist who joined us for an earlier conversation. And I think the fact that Ernesto and and others are here is real testament to the interest your art generates among your peers. Other questions?
I have a question, Greg.
Please.
So you have mentioned the image of the forest to describe your works at least three or four times today. Is that new? Or is something, have you always thought of the
it's always
I say that because there is this beautiful thesis by Simon Schama, and you're living in Germany, about the importance of the image of the forest in German art, and what he calls the forestal German ethnicity. So maybe this is an addition from...
Well, no, the forest has appeared since the beginning, I think.
But you thinking of them as forests.
Yeah. Even the felt pieces have this relation to landscape, this relation to forest. The boy and dwarf has this idea of this entering into this heavy layer piece of paper. So the forest has been important in the relationship. What happens there? You know, what is the idea of the interior and what's the exterior space?
Well, the Galicia piece is literal. It's literal.
Exactly. Yeah, very important.
There's a side to come to sort of continue on the line of the forest. I mean, there's a dimension of your work that's all about childhood, about the kinds of things that we adopt, learn, embrace as kids, especially the comic references. But there's also something deeply threatening about your work, the fact that you've taken this and you've obliterated it, you've tormented it, you've rendered it fragmented, and I just wonder about this tension that exists there between, call it childhood naivete and maybe adult skepticism. Is that threaded in your work intentionally? Are you aware of are you playing out some kind of story between the ways in which life alters our experience?
Well, I think, you know, fairy tales seem to be very harmless, but they're not. So they all have kind of lessons. I mean, Disney kind of softened them up a little bit. He took the rough edges here and there. But where they come from, even with all the cosmetics, we have these references that are kind of deep inside. So when you have these connections to the fragments that you see by a foot, or a castle, or an arm, or a finger, you tend to kind of have a certain connection. You can actually pinpoint exactly what it is. But it is somewhat violent, and it is somewhat disturbing. But again, it uses this language of this everyday part of our culture. So that's why I'm saying that it's so private, because you have a complete different risk to the Pinocchio whale fire than the lady that identified it. So but the act of collage, it is a violent act of cutting by force and by gluing by force to create this new thing. And it's somewhat embedded in this physicality of the piece. So I think, and also children are very cruel. And then we grew up with these connections to these images, and we all have this kind of our baggage with this work, so with this background, so.
The darker side.
Darker side. We all have it. So.
Cunning.
Yes, please.
I just wonder, and maybe a very naive question, but I saw the painting on the building that's going to be gone sometime soon, and I wondered what your feelings are about the things that you paint on a wall that may someday be gone, as opposed to pieces that can go from here to there and somewhere else?
Well, you know, none of the wall paintings, the only wall painting that has been commissioned with dialogue with the architect is the painting at the Homeland Security Building. So that piece will remain there. That is part now of the collection of the U.S. government. So that piece can be changed, and it will be there until the building is destroyed. But part of the other wall paintings, it's part of, that's their nature. to disappear whenever they go. And
you're not uncomfortable.
No, not at all. So the only thing that remains will be a photograph, or it remains the cartoon, or the sketch of the piece, or a drawing of the piece. But that will be the only thing that remains. It's just a temporary placement, 3 months or a year, and then it's gone.
There was a question. Was there a question here? Yes, please. Yes, in the pink sweater. Looks like a pink sweater.
Hi, thank you. And I just would like to know how you feel when you work in your work in the same way that's very well calculated, like you cut, in the same way it's very expressionism for me. I would like to know a very simple question. How do you feel when you're working? Happy or...
I feel good basically.
is there one last question? Yes, over here. You yes, yeah. Did you just put your hand up?
Yeah, I was going to wait for the mic. I was wondering have a deep interest in animation, or if that just happens to be the most accessible resource for your imagery, and if you've ever contemplated animation yourself in your work.
Well, I think the idea of animation has been lurking through the process of the work, especially with the collages Keep in Touch, which uses animation backgrounds, and I told the illustrator to delete, and then this digital projection, which uses some kind of a very syncopated way of fading, fade out, like a slide projection. That's a very primitive level to create some kind of moving image from actually still figures. So I think it's lurking in the process in the studio that something eventually will happen. But I don't know. I don't have the expertise to do it, but hopefully maybe it could happen. But yeah, it's there. So maybe it will come, you know, a couple of years from now.
Please join me. Sorry, you did have a question. I knew there was a question lurking there.
The question in my face hurts something.
Is there a microphone? We'll just do one last question here. Thank you, Laura.
Hi. I'm an artist also, but I don't live here. I'm from Mexico City. And I would like to know your opinion about what's going on now in the art scene here. I mean, this kind of childish imagery that's kind of everywhere.
The what?
Childish imagery, imaginary imagery.
Childhood imagery.
Yeah, it's like this cartoonish world that you see almost in every gallery that you go into.
There's so many shows in New York.
Yeah.
I haven't seen so much of it. Do you have an example of?
I've just been to Chelsea, and it's full with this kind of shows. I can't remember the names of the artists, but many, many artists are working with that source. And it's a question for the three of you, if I may.
Excuse me? For me? Well, I guess it's not new, the reference to childhood and childhood imagery. Obviously, there is this strong afterlife of pop art here, and that makes probably that gives you the impression that it's more present here than in Mexico. But I think it's generally, I don't have the impression this is a new feature of art.
I mean, I think there's an extensive, long tradition now of an interest in popular culture. In comics, and comic abstraction explores one vein of that. And I think one of the aspects of Arturo's work that is so interesting is the way in which he subverts our normal relationship to that kind of popular culture. And it's what gives it, I think, its particular charge, a charge that's not only about the subjectivity that he talked about, if you wish, the ambiguity that allows all of us to read into it what we want, but something even deeper, and Arturo touched on that, which is that it's also about the exploding of these fairy tales and the revealing of the dark, often threatening dimension.
The uncanny
that lurks underneath that. And I think that, among many other aspects, is what makes you such an interesting artist and why we're so grateful, Arturo, that you spent so much time with us. So please thank Arturo Medina.